This is a segment from The Annex, an academic sociology-themed podcast. For more, visit us on the web at theannexpodcast.com. And now we turn to Christine Prochesky from Northwestern University. Christine recently published two terrific articles on union dissolution. Last year in PLOS One, she and Jess Meyer published Health Behaviors in Union Dissolution Among Parents of Young Children, Differences by Marital Status. And more recently, the two published Health and Union Dissolution Among Parenting Couples, Differences by Gender and Marital Status in the Journal of Health and Social Behavior. They were terrific articles, Christine.
Thank you.
So it's a pleasure to have you join us. Thank you for coming.
I'm so excited to talk about this new research.
It was really good. I loved it. So, and it's always great when someone you know and like is doing great work. Let's start off with some basics, because, you know, everybody comes from a different, you know, subsection of the field.
Sure.
You study union dissolution, right? So maybe.
Right. So
go ahead.
Think about divorce or breaking up among cohabiting couples.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And you do it among parents, right?
Parents. So, right.
Wait, cohabitation is on the rise. How prevalent is it among parents?
Yeah. So about 1 in 5 kids are born to a cohabiting couple.
Interesting. So they're both of their biological parents are cohabiting when they are born.
That's right. Couples living together, but not married. And it's much more common than it was just a few decades ago. And many of our studies to date on parents and dynamics between parents have thought about two camps of folks. They've thought about married couples where both biological parents are married to each other. And here we're thinking mothers and fathers, because up until recently, at least in the US case, same-sex marriage wasn't available across the US. So most of those studies have looked at moms and dads married to each other. And the contrast has been single mom families. And in recent decades, we've seen a lot more family diversity along with the rise of moms and dads living together, but who aren't married together, married to each other. Yeah.
And then, first of all, why do they think cohabitation is on the rise among parents who are parenting the same child?
That's a great question. There's a lot of different answers to this. In short, marriage has become less socially necessary, and it's become more feasible for folks to live together without being married. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, the symbolic value of marriage has risen such that many couples and popular society has in place all these expectations, like folks shouldn't get married unless they have some savings. Folks shouldn't get married unless they have money for a big showy wedding. Folks shouldn't get married if they still have a lot of debt or if somebody has an addiction, a substance addiction, or if there's still romantic infidelity or sexual infidelity. And so the bar for what makes a good marriage has risen.
Oh, interesting.
And the resources that people have in some parts of the population have shrunk. So combined with new norms about that it's okay for people to live together without being married. So it's this combination of cultural factors and structural factors and all coming together.
Yeah. So Christine, I have two questions. So the first is, how much of this has to do with, you know, what people have been saying is like the growing secularization of the United States, right? Which, you know, we're still a fairly religious country, right. but we seem to be becoming less so, number one. And number two, the fact that it used to be that when we thought about people who cohabited and even parents who cohabited, we tended to think about lower income individuals, people with lower levels of education. Right. Whereas, like, from what I understand, there's actually been like a pretty significant increase in cohabiting parents who actually have relatively high levels of education.
Yeah. So there, on the first part of that, yes, the religiosity of the U.S. is interesting because we're much more religious country than, let's say, most of Western Europe. Mm-hmm. And that probably has something to do with what's going on here in that we have lower levels of cohabiting parenthood than some countries in Western Europe. Mm-hmm. And cohabiting parenthood is less common among the most religious folks in the U.S. But that said, we have seen this decline in religiosity, and it's even become more common among folks who are religious. Mm-hmm. So the religiosity part of it is complicated, but it's probably part of the story.
Okay.
Regarding the education gradient, yes, there's been an increase in the share of, let's say, people with a college education who have kids while cohabiting and don't wait for marriage to do that. But it is still most common among those with the least education. Mm-hmm. It's moving up through the middle class a bit. So it used to be that it was predominantly among people without a high school degree. And now it's a lot of those some college folks. It's still pretty uncommon for college educated women to have their babies in cohabiting unions instead of in marriage. Mm-hmm.
So wait, tell us a little bit about your studies in particular. So the first one looked at smoking and binge drinking,
right?
Which I understand those to be health problems, right? Like I understand both of your papers to be about the relationship between health problem and separating.
That's right. And so, you know, health conditions and health behaviors are somewhat different. Thinking about starting with health behaviors, right? There's reasons that we might think it's hard to parent your children well if you binge drink regularly or if you're smoking regularly. So
smoking, you think so?
Yes. I mean, there's all this research that secondhand smoke is not good for children.
Fair enough.
And so, you know, it's hard to effectively supervise children if you have to keep leaving the home to smoke outside. And if you don't leave the home to smoke outside, then you're exposing your children to secondhand smoke. Mm-hmm. And in the U.S. context, we've also put on high taxes onto smoking and onto the sale of cigarettes, which means, you know, it's a substantial part of some families' budgets, or it's a substantial hit to budgets to maintain a smoking habit. So, you know, certainly some families have enough income that it's not taking away from kids' resources. But for a lot of families, you know, an expensive smoking habit is impacting kid resources available to children.
Totally.
And binge drinking, again, hard to think about how you're effectively supervising children if you're regularly binge drinking. Now, you can imagine scenarios where people arrange their schedules so that somebody else is in charge of the children on the days that they want to binge drink. And perhaps perhaps that, you know, maybe that doesn't have an impact. But, you know, thinking more broadly, yes.
Right.
There's reasons to think it's hard to effectively parent when you're binge drinking or smoking a lot. And then we can think about what impact that has on your partner. Right. So if you're not able to effectively parent, or if you're putting a big dent in the family budget by purchasing alcohol or smoking, that may be unsettling to your partner and may require them to do more or them to go out without resources. Mm-hmm. And that might make them a less desirable partner.
Right. And then your second one looks at self-reported health, depression, and work limitations. You know, it was funny. I heard it was somebody did a study. I forget where I heard it, but it was something like spouses are 10 times more likely to ask whether or not their spouse is cheating on them than if their husband's behavior is related to depression.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Like it's but the role of depression, work limitations and health.
Right. So health status is very different in some, or is different than health behaviors. And, mm-hmm. you know, here we don't know about all of the mechanisms, but you might think that if you're dealing with a health problem or a health challenge, it requires different, it changes the dynamics of a couple, potentially. Mm-hmm. It changes what they're able to contribute to the family. It potentially creates caregiving burdens or shifts caregiving burdens within a family. Mm-hmm. In the U.S. context, it also has impacts on family finances, both because of the costs of treatment and lack of insurance, et cetera, but also impacting your ability to earn for your family.
And can you talk a little bit about gender effect?
Right. And so in both articles, both when we're looking at health behaviors and health status or health characteristics, we're interested in thinking about, okay, in the U.S. context, there's different norms for parents based on their gender. We have different norms for mothers and fathers. Of course, not in every family, but broadly, you know, there are different social norms for mothers and fathers. And there are different social norms for folks who are married versus folks who are living together. And we have these stronger norms about how wives and husbands should behave versus how cohabiting partners should behave. And there's a lot of work that suggests that there's stronger gender norms in marriage than in cohabitation.
I can tell you that from my experience.
Right? And so this doesn't mean that everyone adheres to them, or that in any particular couple that there are stronger norms or different norms, or that things would change or not when folks get married. But in general, there's this sense that there are different norms. And so we expected some health behaviors and some health conditions to have a different impact or have a different association with union dissolution for married versus cohabiting couples and for mothers versus fathers. And for example, there's a lot of work that suggests men deal with depression differently than women do. Men are less likely to seek treatment, and the way that depression manifests itself looks a little different on average in men than women. And so men are more likely to exhibit aggression or aggressive behaviors when they suffer from depression. And so you might think that that would be particularly disruptive to family dynamics, men's aggressive behaviors, or men are more likely to self-medicate with alcohol. Again, that may be more detrimental to family life than women's withdrawal from family life, for example.
So what did you find? What were the gender effects that you found?
Yeah, so we found that men's depression or father's depression is more strongly associated with union dissolution than women's or the mother's. We found that mother's self-rated health, married mother's self-rated health, poor self-rated health predicts dissolution. Now, why would it be married women's and not cohabiting women's? We don't know. And self-rated health captures a lot of different health conditions. Unfortunately, in the data that we were able to analyze, we don't have more detail about what's going on there. And then lastly, we found that married fathers' health-related work limitations predicted divorce. And so if you have a health condition that limits your ability to be employed, it didn't impact whether couples broke up if it was the mom who had that work-limiting health condition, or if it were was a cohabiting father. But if it was a married father, it did predict divorce. And we think that reflects that there's still a very strong norm in the U.S. for male breadwinning in marriage, especially among parents.
For cohabiting, was it also for those cohabiting?
No, fathers who have these work limitations, we don't see that associated with dissolution. Now, so there could be some reasons, like the cohabiting couples break up at much higher rates to begin with. And so it may be that they're just not together long enough. Or that fewer of them are together long enough. But here we think there's reasonably strong evidence here that it's about different norms, or that it might be partially about different norms about breadwinning.
Yeah, I think that's amazing.
And then the other thing that I found interesting in your paper was this argument that, you know, we hear people argue for marriage by saying, you know, married people live longer and they're healthier, happier. But your study suggests that there might be people afflicted by health problems might be getting selected out of marriages. So we're only looking at the healthy remainders.
Yes. And, you know, I should say that that is part of the story. I think there's some good evidence, though, that it's only part of the story, and that there might be this treatment effect of marriage on health. That couples engage in different caretaking behaviors, different health monitoring behaviors. They have access to different resources when they're married versus when they're cohabiting. And so, you know, my read of the evidence is that for some types of couples, there does seem to be a marriage impact on their health. But there is also this big thing where men and women who engage in risky health behaviors don't tend to stay married as long. Men and women who have certain types of health conditions are more likely to be divorced. So it's both. and if we don't have, you know, the world's best evidence, because we don't randomly assign people to marriage. We don't randomly assign people to break up.
Right.
But I think the available evidence suggests, yes, part of the story is that people who have certain types of health challenges are more likely to divorce, and people who engage in certain kinds of risky health behaviors are more likely to divorce.
So what about in sickness and in health, though? Isn't that what marriage is supposed to be about?
Yes, and in fact, one of our early titles for this article was "In Sickness and in Health."
But oh, yeah, we realized totally.
Somebody else had already used that title.
Oh, for sure. Oh, that's the pits. Right, that's the worst.
Right. So that was one of the competing hypotheses. I mean, you might have this hypothesis that, you know, married couples have a stronger bond because they explicitly in their vows, not always but often, mm-hmm. pledge in sickness and in health. And in some ways we see that, but we also see that there's stronger norms about what married couples should be doing and right. strong, you know, and to the extent that health interferes with being the kind of spouse that in the U.S. today we expect in a marriage, it's problematic. One of my colleagues here at Northwestern, Eli Finkel, who's a psychologist, has this great book on, you know, what we expect from marriages today and how that's somewhat realistic. You know, we expect marriage to fulfill all of these personal fulfillment goals, and we expect our spouses to do all of these things and to be our everything. And that's a really high bar that few marriages can hit. Right?
Yeah, totally.
So in generations past, people expected something different from marriage. They expected their spouse to help take care of their kids. They expected their spouse maybe to be a partner in household production, mm-hmm. but they didn't expect their spouse to help them reach this high level of fulfillment and to be, you know, their primary conversation partner and their right. primary this and their only that and to fulfill all their deepest emotional needs. That's a new expectation that we have of marriage.
Do you think that there's a selection effect, you know, where maybe traditionally minded people, you know, with sort of traditional views choose marriage and those who cohabit?
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm sure that's part of it, but that should have run against my findings or our findings that some of these health conditions predicted split up more among marriage than yeah. among cohabitation. Absolutely. And we try to take that into account a little bit in our statistical models. So we include things like a measure of whether both partners go to church or mm-hmm. go to religious services weekly. We include a measure of gender ideology, right? Because if it's really just about folks with the most gender traditional roles are married, or folks who attend religious services weekly are married, then we should have been able to sort of control for that a little bit. That said, there's all these reasons people marry and or don't marry that are really hard to capture in a statistical model. So there's certainly selection into marriage, right. but we're looking at, in some ways, the selection out of marriage. And that's interesting too.
So like you've thought about marriage, I guess you've been pondering over it for quite yes. a while. So like through this journey, like what's marriage all about then?
a lot of different things to a lot of different people.
rats. Yeah, I mean, that's probably the right answer, as it often is, right?
All right. A lot of different things to a lot of different people. That said, we have certain social expectations in the U.S., and some of them are changing, but some of them are not. Yeah. So most mothers with young children work today. Mm-hmm. But we still seem to have this expectation that fathers need to be breadwinners.
Yeah.
And, you know, in some ways that undermines a lot of marriages where the father, for various reasons, either structural reasons, the kind of job he used to work in has disappeared, health reasons, he doesn't have the health to do that, discrimination, you know, that he has a criminal record and his, you know, he's effectively been banned from employment. I mean, there's lots of reasons why men and fathers who'd like to be working can't. And this strong social norm might undercut what would otherwise be stable marriages.
For more, visit us on the web, theannexpodcast.com.